First, I'll turn on this audio recording, and then I'll pop into Illuminate and turn on the audio here. So welcome to both of you in the Illuminate room. I see my popularity continues undaunted, and we'll start the Illuminate recording. So
recording started.
This looks better on the slide than it does up there. Here's what the proper slide looks like, and I was very pleased with it. And then, of course, the Illuminate version comes out, and it changes the size of some of the text, and it comes out a bit odd. But so I'm hoping the rest of the slides will work. Basically, this is the story of my visit to Edmonton. And it starts with, it doesn't start with a flight. And my visit to Edmonton is challenging some of my thoughts on representation and resemblance, particularly as they have to do with learning and learning theory. If I were to ever produce this into something formal like a paper, then this would be called a work in progress. And I want you to think of it that way. This is me wrestling with some ideas. So please don't expect polish or even penetrating insight. This is just me working some ideas around. But I think possibly in ways that will be useful and ways that will be relevant to this particular group. So I came at this from the perspective of representation, and I'll explain how I got there in just a couple of minutes. But when I came up with the title of The Representative Student, I realized it was one of those titles that I love, like critical literacies, right? Literacies that are critical to learn, or literacies that offer you a critical stance on the world. And the representative student is one of those two. The representative student could be the student that is typical of or a model of other students. Could be a student who engages in acts of representation, or, and this speaks to my days in student government when I used to live in the city, it's a student who stands for or represents other students. And you can see that these are all different flavors of the same sort of concept. And this is really what I want to explore. Whoops, I don't just hit enter. So, in my visit to Edmonton, I was faced with two challenges, one yesterday and one today. The one yesterday, I had a long conversation about the role of models and simulation in learning. Now, I'm one of these people when people say, well, we should use Second Life or, you know, games are the future. I kind of roll my eyes a little bit. I know what people mean, but Second Life, I mean, really? Seriously? You know? But the proposition was put to me, and put to me sufficiently forcefully, that learning systems in the future, beginning now, because a lot of these are under development, are systems that represent or model rather than contain information about. And that makes sense to me. But even to take this a little bit further, because I talked about some of my work with personal learning environments and then some of the challenges that I have getting people to move off the idea of learning management systems and toward personal learning environments, because people don't believe me when I say things. And it was put to me, well, maybe you don't say things well enough. And so I rolled my eyes a little bit. He said, no, hear me out. Because what I'm attempting to do is to convince people that something like a personal learning environment is the best way to manage learning, but I haven't shown this. And the way you show this is, interestingly, the way you teach, to create a model or a representation. Well, I thought, well, that's interesting. So that's the first challenge. is this challenge to my own thinking about learning and representation of learning through modeling a representation. So that's bugging me. The second challenge, and I can't just click and make it work, I have to use the mouse. The second challenge has to do with Kinshuk, who's sitting right beside me, who I've never met before, so I feel privileged and very pleased, because I've been reading, you know, and following Kinshuk for many years. And I didn't have the opportunity of listening to his talking about adaptive learning this morning. So if I contradict what he said, sorry. And if what I say supports what he said, we planned it all along. And there's a lot of discussion, especially in the area of electronic learning system, computerized learning system, computer-based learning, etc., of adaptive learning. And I thought about that because what I talk about a lot, especially when I talk about personal learning, has very little to do with adaptive learning, and indeed, it's another one of these things that makes me roll my eyes, right? Is adaptive learning really? Pre-tests? I'm going to skip a learning object? I'm going to respond to input? Is this learning design? You know what I mean? And so, I talk about, and George talks about, students as participants in a network, in perhaps an online community of inquiry. And, okay, I'm thinking about that, but that puts this polarization, I don't want to call it a polarization, but this dilemma in front of me. Maybe what I'm saying is students are supposed to be adapting to these learning systems like online networks, and we shouldn't be surprised if they're not, because we're trying to cram students into these computer-sized holes. And maybe our computer system should adapt to us. I don't want to set this up as a polarization, but there's a tension here, right? It's not, I don't know what I meant by not simply a deus ex machina question, ex machina? I never know how to pronounce that. But, it's not man versus the machine that I'm setting up here. But what do we mean when we say adaption or adaptation? So that's the frame. And I thought about this. I'm thinking about this last night, actually, this morning, shortly before this talk. I realized my attempt to respond to both of these is what I'm trying to do with connectivism. Thanks, George, for the name. Connectivism is an attempt to respond to both of these sorts of questions. Connectivism is an attempt to respond to the whole modeling and representation thing, and it is an attempt to respond to the whole adaptation thing, adaptive systems thing. Connectivism, there's lots of ways, and you guys have already had the connectivism talk, right?
Very short version.
George and I have put together these connectivist courses. I'm doing one now called Critical Literacies. We just had a wonderful session in that this morning while you guys were here in Kinshuk. Pardon?
He was boring you that time. I was having good.
Yeah. We had Graham Atwell and Jen Hughes on talking about syntax and etc. It was good stuff. I'll be posting a link to the recording of that. You might want to listen to that. So connectivism is kind of like communities of practice, kind of like a core structure that's a model or is the real world structure. And the activity in a connectivist course is, the activity of receiving, working with, creating, and now here's where my disjunction gets going, ideas or resources or objects, maybe even learning objects, or, and this is my new thinking, models, right? So that's the connectivism thing is, on one hand, a model of things, and on the other hand, a working with models. Okay, well, I can dig that. That's good. So I'm pretty pleased with that. So what's a model? A model is a representation. What's a representation? A representation is a complex construction. I don't like where this is going. This isn't what we do, is it? Well, it is. You know, I mean, we sort of do sometimes, and we sort of don't do other times, but it's certainly not what we have in mind in connectivism. Okay. What is connectivism, then, from the perspective of models? Well, connectivism basically equates model building with network building. Now, George might disagree with that, but I don't think he's going to seriously disagree with it. We're not constructing buildings, sort of atoms and Legos and things like that, right? We're not assembling sequences of learning objects, nor either are we assembling sequences of sentences. Although these all might be activities within a connectivist context, they're not what define a connectivist context. It's also an act of modeling in the sense of what happens in the neuron is what happens in the network. What happens in the individual person is what happens out there in the world. We form these patterns of connectivity, these neural networks in our mind, and we call that thinking. And we form these patterns of connectivity between people, between ideas, between things in the real world. Maybe I should say the external world, because it's no more or less real than what goes on in our minds. And we call that social thinking or, you know, social connectivism. Never mind. I, in my various writings, have depicted this as two separate things with points of relation between them. George, I think, sometimes depicts it as one and the same thing. The expression, for example, the outboard brain, suggests a continuity between the network that exists out there in the world and the network that exists in one's head. I see these as quite a bit more separate. The knowledge that is had by a society through its connections of individuals, ideas, things, etc., is distinct from and not contiguous with the knowledge that is had by a person in their mind. Now, that gives me a problem that George doesn't have, and that is, how do I join these two things? The knowledge in the world and the knowledge in the mind. George doesn't have it because it's all one. So far, so good, George?
We're different on the same page.
I love that. You like my truck? Well, how to represent this? What George promotes is what I'm going to call, nastily, simple connectivism. I'm sorry, George, but simple connectivism. And that is the idea, as I've just expressed, what happens in the neuron is what happens in the network. You look at what's happening in the mind, you have connections and things like that, and you apply that out to the world. The neuron connects to other neurons, ergo, things in the network connect to other things in the network. The contrast, what I'll call my version, nastily, complex connectivism, and it's still what happens in the neuron is what happens in the network, but what's happening in the network out there are these complex representational structures. including even that complex representation I showed you earlier that I said wasn't really what we're doing, but it is kind of what we're doing. It's just, it's all out there, and you won't see it in neurons. But really, if that's what we're doing out there in the world, then that's what we're doing in our head, isn't it? See, it's the same theory, but the directionality is different. The directionality of simple connectivism is from the mind out to the world. The directionality of complex connectivism is from the world into the mind. It's the same thing. There's nothing different between the two things. It's just ways of looking at it. I'm still working this through, right? So, well, I don't smoke anymore, but I thought this would be a pretty good example. Because everybody's heard of Freud and cigars, and you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, okay? So let's use that as the model to explain the distinction between simple connectivism and complex connectivism. Simple connectivism, you see thoughts of cigars, you say the whole world is made of cigars. And we will understand all of the world from the perspective of these cigars. And that sounds really silly when you talk about cigars, but it sounds a lot less silly when you talk about connections. It's the same sort of thing. Complex connectivism is we have thoughts of cigars, but there are various meanings of what a cigar is, based on how we use it, based on how we interpret it, what the cultural connotations are. And so we understand our thought of a cigar from the perspective of that. Now, what does that mean in concrete terms? Neuron A is connected to neuron B. That's what we have in the mind. We take that kind of thing and see the world through that light. Fair enough. Perfectly legitimate. Something that I do too. That's simple connectivism. Complex connectivism. Neuron A is connected to neuron B. What does that mean from the perspective of the world out there? We bring our knowledge of the world out there in order to frame an understanding of neuron A as connected to neuron B. It's a different way of looking at the same thing. It's what Dennett would call the intentional stance. We are looking at brain phenomena, but from the perspective, vocabulary, ontological systemology, I just made that up, of the world. Does that make sense?
Kind of. Is there a particular point at which we would like to discuss this?
Yeah.
Or do you need to build more of your argument before we...
No, I've got more coming.
All right, then continue.
Yeah. This is just a framework, all right? You don't have to buy the framework, but let me have the vocabulary for now. And in fact, I won't be using the vocabulary either now that I think about it. But I want to draw those ways of looking at the networks, the connections. Because like I say, I've got this problem that George doesn't have. And my problem is, how do I explain, how do I describe, how do I even talk about what's going on in the student's mind if it's not contiguous with, if it's not part and parcel with what's happening out there. And I believe that these are two separate things. So, what critical literacies is an attempt to get at this. We're offering a course in critical literacies. As each week goes by, I realize how more audacious that was. But nonetheless, it's still a good project to try. The reason why we wanted to offer a course in critical literacies is we're building a personal learning environment, and our explanation of why we need to build a personal learning environment is that this is how people can learn. But the problem is, how do you learn with a personal learning environment? What capacities do you need? To learn in a classroom, you need to read and write, maybe draw pictures, sit up straight and pay attention. Those are the skills required in a classroom. In a personal learning environment, there's a different set of skills, and we're trying to get at what these are, because a lot of people say, with some degree of convincingness, that I just made up the word convincingness, but I'm not sure what the real word would be. People just set loose on the world without structure and guidance won't be able to do anything. Oh, that seems to me not to be true, but it is true that they have to have certain capacities, certain skills, certain abilities in order to be productive and useful, or at least able to learn, right? What are those skills? Critical literacies is an attempt to get at those skills. So, with that now, taking that in mind and taking the current discussion in mind, what are the critical literacies? The critical literacies are an attempt to get at the complex representational structures that are out there that we need to have in here in order to work with the network that's out there. Okay. Sounded good. What does that mean? Does that's, you know, I say that and it's just, okay, well, what does that mean? Okay, well, let's think about the mechanisms of a connectivist course. I've tried to characterize, especially in the current course, the mechanisms of a connectivist course with a fairly simple model that I've used for a number of years now, and I think does describe what we ask people to do. And it's the ARF model, which we decided to name in honor of Alan Levine. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. To aggregate is to bring stuff in from out there in the world. To remix is, you know, well, it's remixing, it's mashing up, it's bricolage, it's bringing things together. To repurpose is to change, adapt, transfer, fold, spindle, and mutilate. And then to feed forward is to send this forward, to publish it, to share it. And that's the model of connectivism. And that's what we do in connectivist courses. And I know George agrees with me 100% on that. So that's good. In that context, then, here are the six critical literacies that form the foundation of the critical literacies course and represent, I say, the skills and capacities that are needed in order to function in this representationalist way in a connectivist course. Keeping in mind, this is just a first stab at it. It's probably pretty good. It's probably pretty close. I actually did teach critical thinking in this very institution in which I sit, although it was over there, so I guess I didn't literally sit here. Anyhow, for 7 years. So there's a bit of a background coming into play here. The six critical literacies, cognition, and all forms of cognition, I argue, can be described as argument, explanation, definition, and description. Whether or not it's exhaustive, who cares, but it probably is. Change, patterns of change, different ways of representing change, different kinds of change, understanding change, recognizing change, criticizing change. Pragmaticism, which is a term from Charles Sanders Peirce. It's not pragmatism and it's not pragmatics, and it's something I should have been a lot clearer about when I first introduced it in these six critical literacies. Pragmaticism is the theory that the meaning of an utterance, that is to say a sentence or a proposition, is the effect that you expect or intend to generate as a cause of as a consequence of uttering it. So the meaning of the word fire isn't the fact that there is or is not a fire. The meaning of the word fire is get out of the theater now. Because that's what you expect everyone who hears that to do. Well, okay, that's pragmaticism, Benjamin Franklin, or not Benjamin, Charles Sanders Peirce style. But, you know, there's the whole wider study of the use, effect, and cause, and consequence of utterance. Syntax, which we normally think of as the grammar or the meaning of a representation, typically a sentential representation, such as a sentence in English, but really could be any sort of representation, video, movie. Susan Metros, who will be bringing into the course in a couple of weeks, talks about the syntax of images. And I learned quite a bit about the syntax of graphic design when I worked on the student newspaper and all the ways you can manipulate the way people think, not by saying things, but just by ordering things differently on the page of a newspaper. Put the big picture of Barack Obama beside a big picture of a goat. You're not calling Barack Obama a goat, but you'd be surprised at how many people, after you've done this for a couple of years, begin to think he's a goat. And that's part of the syntax. Syntax are the rules for her construction. Syntax also, if you follow people like Rudolf Carnap, denote the range of possibilities. And that's why I really enjoyed the presentation today from Jen Hughes, channeling Saussure and describing syntax as the range of possibilities inherent in the creation of a sentence. So syntax isn't just rules, it's just rules and possibilities. And the possibilities are framed by the rules. Understand the rules, you understand the possibilities. Conversely, understand the possibilities, you understand the rules. Context frames, to quote George Lakoff, perspectives, cultures, the influence of environment and ecology on the meaning or on the intentionality of an utterance. And then finally, semantics, which has to do not just with truth and reference and representation, but also meaning and general goals and desires. These are the features of a representation. These are also the skills you require in order to construct a representation. And these are also the tools that you have in order to create a message or send the communication. Now, we can argue on the precise nature of these. You know, there's a huge, ridiculously huge body of writing in the area of critical theory and media studies and all of that. You know, huge, huge, huge piles of continentalist stuff. And, but, you know, something like that gets at what we need to do in order to create representational systems. Having said that, what that means, if everything else I've said is true, is something like this represents the foundational skills necessary for learning. Which means when we're creating models or theories of learning, they need to take these into account. So far, so good? Go ahead.
How about metacognition?
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning self-regulatory capacities for planning, self-evaluation, reflection, self-efficacy, and that
sort of thing. Sure. Throw that into the mix. Whether it's subsumed under these or becomes a category of its own, that's...
Yeah, I see the word goals.
Yeah.
And the semantics.
Yeah. So, you know, and like, understand how this is presented, right? This is not an ontology. This is a set of points, right? And look at it from a different perspective. Instead of these six layers, you get a different six layers, in which metacognition might be one of them. You're absolutely right in including it. And it's simply a matter of how do we represent it to make that part of the picture. I was in a meeting, very serious meeting yesterday, reviewing a proposal. My phone rings for the first time. It's a brand new phone because NRC took away my BlackBerry because they have to pay for a certain meeting that's taking place. And so the government doesn't have any money anymore. So I had to buy a new phone. And it rings for the first time. And the BlackBerry had a very quiet ring, so I had to crank it up, and you know, and it would still sort of, right, and it hardly vibrated. This phone, bang! I look around, whose phone is ringing? Because I'm not, nobody knows my phone number. This is my phone. Yeah. Okay. These six literacies, or six classes of literacies, aspects of experience, aspects of thought, and aspects of communication. In other words, aspects of aggregation, aspects of remixing and repurposing, aspects of feeding forward. Just a frame for reference, but you know, if I keep things in these nice, neat boxes, they're easier to handle. They are, as I said, at once the constituents of the model, but there are also the skills involved in understanding and communicating the model. They are components of representation, and they are what is involved in representation. I love words. Words are so fun. You try to pin them down. Now we've got this structure, this idea, this frame as to what's going on, this complex connectivism, right? So we've got these representational structures, and these representational structures are how we are understanding what's going on inside the mind, a la the intentional stance. We're taking a perspective or point of view in order to understand the connections between these neurons. So, how do we now kick this into action and start making inferences and drawing conclusions? Zenon Polition, writing about the philosophy of mind, talks about something he calls the objective pull. Explain what this is. You have a thought, and everybody close your eyes and imagine, a thought of a wheel turning. Close your eyes and imagine a wheel turning, okay? And if you've actually practiced this, you can actually visualize the wheel. I have practiced this, and it's one of these mental exercises, and you can do it, right? If you can hear a tune in your head, you can see a wheel turning in your head. It's just we have a lot more practice hearing a tune because we do it all the time, and we hardly ever try to picture wheels turning. But, you know, start with something concrete that, you know, like a car wheel or I don't know, Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune. It's not Jeopardy, right? So, okay, so the wheel is turning. What governs the movement of that wheel? The objective pull, according to Volition, is the fallacious belief that the laws of nature governing wheels in the world are the same laws that govern how the wheel turns in your mind. All right? But obviously, whatever is happening in your mind is not governed by laws of nature. Or at least not those laws of nature. They're governed by laws of nature, but not the laws of nature, because there isn't really a wheel in your mind, right? So how do we turn a wheel in our mind? Polition is responding to theorists such as Stephen Kosslyn, who say we actually have an image of a wheel in our mind. So in a sense, there really is a wheel turning in our mind. It's just it's an image, a copy, a reflection is the old empiricist, old Humean picture of ideas being impressions or reflections of our experience in the world. And Politian is saying, poppycock. What's really happening is we're going through a process of syntactical operations. And even though you can actually do experiments that show that the manipulation of representations in our mind resemble actual representations of objects in the world, it's just because of the nature of the syntactical operations and not the fact that one is a copy of the other. So, and most people, in kind of a folk psychological way, think that this is how we think. That we don't really have pictures of wheels in our mind, but really we have sentences, propositions about wheels in our mind. Well, against that, because I don't agree with Politian at all. I think he's full of sentences. I offer what I call the linguistic pull, which is, and interestingly, and this came up yesterday, in the context of these problems I'm working with, interestingly, this is the subject of my master's thesis, but written completely differently in 230 very wordy pages. But really, this is what I was trying to say. Now I realize this 20 years later. The linguistic pull is the tendency to view the objects represented in the terms of the representation. So if we have, say, a linguistic representation of a human, we tend to think of humans as governed by linguistic properties. For example, the meaning of life. Meaning is a property of sentences, not humans. But we've taken this property of sentences and applied it to humans. Maybe you don't like meaning of life, but, you know, I mean, there are many things about sentences, you know, the scope of possibilities that we can come up with linguistically representing the scope of possibilities that a human could possibly have. You know, gender, male or female. But what we are learning today and what's really important about connectivism is that representations can be created out of anything, not just linguistic entities, or not just created and can be found, they can be grown, etc. And that these linguistic properties are just one set of the properties a representation can have. You take these six critical literacies that I've been talking about thus far. One of the things I've tried to do in the course is to think of them not as linguistic properties, but as properties of representations generally. So when we talk about syntax, I think syntax not just of sentences and words, but syntax of images, syntax of video, syntax of dance, syntax of whatever. And when you think of it that way, you have to think of it differently, because now it's not simply rules for the construction of a logically correct or well-formed formula. It's something else. Yeah.
Besides the art, it's all about it. That's it. It's pretty much all about it.
Sure.
I mean, they have a very precise syntax if you look about all these phenomena, all these paradoxes they are discussing about. They are experimenting very, very nicely with syntax, definition of the syntax, and the instances, utterances of these particular syntaxes.
I agree. I'm not saying this is new. Goodness, no. Far be it from me to say I'm inventing any of this stuff. I'm always the first to deny that this is mine. You know, Gardner's multiple intelligences. Right? Badly miscast as theories about how we learn or theories about the adaptations that instructors must make in order to get people to memorize little bits of propositional knowledge really are more representation or more representative of different representative systems. And again, various forms of syntax, of ways of construction, of patterns within different forms of representation. Nothing new here. So, let's come back to adaptive software. What are we representing about students? We have these computer systems that are adaptive systems, but what are they actually doing? Well, what they do, the way they're typically constructed, is to create propositions or triples, sets of facts about students, and they'll use those facts in order to power some sort of recommender system or to, at the very least, change the mode of presentation, the font, the color scheme, whatever. That's the sort of thing an adaptive system would do. But what is it really for a computer system to learn about a student? I've been reading Jaron Lanier's You Are Not a Gadget, and again, this is the sort of thing that I was thinking about 20 years ago in this badly miscast master's thesis. The representations are abstract. They force you into categories. They force you into ways of being. The possibilities that are open to you are the possibilities that are in the drop-down list. And if it's not in the drop-down list, it's not one of the things that you can be or have or do or whatever. And, you know, I say that, and it's on my mind because I'm fighting with developers who want to do input validation. And I'm saying, I don't want them to do input validation. And the developers say, well, what if they put in the wrong kind of data? And so there isn't a right kind of data. Well, and they say, well, what if it's a date? Well, I don't care if they say Halloween. Also talking about representing information in medical information, and people are talking about, well, how do you get prescription information into the system? The doctor says, take two with supper. That's a complete and full prescription. What the doctor means, kind of, isn't it, is, take two once a day right before your evening meal. But the question is, was the prescription full and complete and properly described when the doctor said it, or did we need to go through this somehow of flaking and forming it into the structure defined by the computer system? And my argument there is the same as my argument here. What the doctor said was full and complete and did not need more interpreting. Many ways to represent linguistic structures are just one way to represent mathematical structures, videos, paintings, songs, gestures, behaviors. And I know you guys can come up with more. So we come back to the models, even. And here, anytime I think about games and models, I think of the classification offered by people like Clark Aldrich. Different kinds of games. There's the quiz game, which will test propositional knowledge, the branch and tree kind of game. I really hate those because all you have to do is remember the branches and trees. But anyhow, they putatively test process knowledge. The database kind of game, like SimCity, where you manipulate related cells in a database We'll test system knowledge, an actual simulation like Flight Simulator or I like the baseball games, right? We'll test spatial knowledge, and there will be more kinds of games, more kinds of representation. But now we're well beyond the realm of propositional syntactic representation. The whole discussion really, in my mind, is an argument between cognitivism and connectionism. And connectivism, as you may guess, falls on the side of connectionism. Where cognitivism, the representations are like sentences. You talk to people like Jerry Fodor or Chomsky or Polishin, the representations are sentences. You talk to Fodor, the representations are sentences, and those sentences are in the head, and not only that, they're innate, and you actually have a vocabulary in your head out of which you build these representations. The world is as you could possibly have thought it was. The representational realism in this kind of model is a theory of truth. The grammar is guaranteed by the properties of the mind and the world to be true through some sort of representational theory, innateness theory, causal theory, some sort of thing. In connectionism, representations are not signs, they're not like sentences, they're patterns. And in representation, in a connectionist system, representational realism is the idea that these patterns are guaranteed by properties of the mind or of the world, and again, causal systems, etc., to resemble what's out there in the world. There's a different kind of relation, a different kind of way of thinking about the contents of our mind. Now, again, we have this tendency in our society to represent everything as an either-or, and cognitivism versus connectionism isn't a dualism. Rather, I would say that cognitivism is a very small bit of connectionism. Cognitivism is a decision, and it should be a conscious decision, to focus on a certain set of patterns, that set of patterns being linguistic structures that we would find in typical computer representations or bodies of knowledge such as we find in the semantic web. But these patterns are limited by their vocabulary, they're limited by their expressiveness, and they create a false perception of precision, as though getting the wording just right means that you're actually being more accurate rather than simply being more precise. It's kind of, if you work with images, you do photo manipulation, there's a sharpness function. Sharpness function is like getting the wording right. And you can crank sharpness all the way up, and your pictures will be crisp, clear, and sharp, but they won't look like what you saw out there in the world anymore. Precision is not the same as resemblance. Oops. So, way back in my own prehistory, I came up with something called the resemblance theory of mind, where we say not that A is a model of B because it stands for B, but rather A is a model of B because it resembles B. And they're two very different systems. The representational theory of mind, A is a model of B because it represents B, means that your inferences are going to be based in the linguistic properties of the entities. A is a model of B because it resembles B means that you are not going to be constrained by the linguistic properties. And it allows for a much wider range of inference, a much wider range of representation, a much wider range of modeling. So, and I'm not going to go on because I know I don't have a whole lot more time.
I mean, given that I'm kind of completely from software language engineering and software linguistics, and all these phenomena are pretty much studied in that community, almost I would say, same way, right? So when we say basically what is a model is a representation of a system, and then that relationship representational has three different important properties. One is the mapping feature, the second one is reduction feature, and finally is the programmatic feature. There is
that
one. That resemblance is basically to do that. Also, unities study quite a lot of conceptual art there, and Marguerite is a really brilliant example. We are using actually his famous picture of a pipe, where basically the pipe is used and it's written below the pipe, this is not a pipe.
Yeah, I know, I've seen those.
And that's really beautiful because that's really not a pipe. That's just a representation of a type.
Well, we can have fun with it, too. We can go and do the whole theory of types thing and have a sentence that says this is not a sentence. But, you know, I don't think, I mean, let me ask you pointedly, are you saying I'm false or trivial, or wrong or trivial? I mean, you're obviously offering a criticism. I don't know what it is.
Right. My actually concerns here. This is in principle quite well studied in all of the like any discipline. So I'm not quite sure when I'm looking at this interpretation of connectivism with all these features, how is different, say, from all this theory we have in modeling.
So okay.
We have like precise definition of what is a model, what is like a syntax, what is the pragmatics of the language. What is, and we are also, when we are looking to the life cycle of a language, we are also considering the reasons why certain languages are this. We are also considering cognitive capture of a language. We are also considering.
Stop. Okay. Are you saying that everything I've said is already known?
I'm not sure how I should interpret this, like, your model of these things. So, how should I?
Yeah. But I mean, you're sitting there saying everything here is already known. And I can tell you right now, that is false. It may be accurate to say, from a certain perspective, everything here is already defined. And if it's computer scientists, you can be sure it's defined eight ways over Sunday. That doesn't make it right.
No,
so in what way is what I'm talking about different from what you're talking about? I'm not claiming it's new.
So I'm just not sure what all this theory is like novel or how this.
I'm not claiming it's novel. You're putting requirements here that I'm not making a claim of.
I'm just not so sure.
I mean, this isn't a PhD oral exam. I don't have to be new or novel. All I'm trying to do is explain a mechanism and an approach to representation. Now, is what I'm saying wrong in some important way? If so, what way? Saying that it's known and that it's trivial isn't helpful. So what were you trying to say?
I'm trying to say that if I already have the theory of modeling, if I already have the definitions of all these things, and these things are already known to the post-history of linguistics and everything, I'm just wondering how connectivism represented to all these features so far is a new thing, why we should call it connectivism.
I'm not even making that argument. Why is this relevant?
I'm just wondering why this is a process. That's my question. I'm not arguing. I agree on every single sentence you put on this. My question is why we are capturing it into this when we are describing. So I'm trying to reason, and then I'm saying like certain set of sentences, and I'm saying that this set of sentences is probably shared with all of you.
I really appreciate the vote of confidence that you've given me in saying that what I'm saying here is well supported in linguistics theory. That was my objective, was to get it right. Right? So I appreciate that. But pointing out that I am right and consistent with everything that has been said so far in linguistics is hardly a criticism of it.
I guess you maybe described it. You're describing a cow, and you said, yes, you described a cow, but is there anything novel or new coming out? And I think that's what I'd like to get into the discussion, is, you know, how does this influence...
Can I have my last five slides, and maybe it'll come to a conclusion? Okay. Because I have, perhaps painstakingly, perhaps repetitively to some, tried to create a structure and an approach and a description. I believe that what I have said may have been new to some of the people in this room, and if so, that's useful, and if not, I'm sorry for boring you. So, where I was here was talking about the resemblance theory of mind, and if you can find that somewhere in all of these descriptions, you let me know. There's a logic of similarity, a logic of associations, where our inferences from one representation to another or one part of a representation to another proceed not through syntactic structures, not through manipulations such as modus ponens, perhaps, or equivalents, but rather through mechanisms of similarity. And these mechanisms, I've described these elsewhere, these mechanisms are forms of association, such as basic Hebbian association, where two things that are active at the same time will be connected with other things. With back propagation, where networks of connected entities will produce outputs, and there will be feedback sent back into these networks to correct the connections between these networks. These mechanisms of association are well studied. And again, I claim nothing new here. And indeed, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the work of Rummelhart and McClellan and in parallel distributed processing, or for that matter, Minsky and Papert and their work on perceptrons, about these mechanisms of association. And if I wanted to, I could go back and talk about Humean philosophy and the association of ideas. Now, there are different ways of representing similarity. My preference is to represent similarity following Amos Tversky as feature-based similarity, rather than what I was hearing just last week, where similarity is gauged by the distance inside a hierarchical structure of related terms. Feature-based similarity maps feature by feature how much overlap there is between two entities, and then because there is no other mechanism to select between which features are most important, you need to bring in the concept of salience or context dependency, and this is described in detail by Robert Stonacher. So inference in this sort of model is a form of similarity-based production, rather than a cognitivist inference-based, semantically-based production. It's a bit of an aside, but this is the model I think human brains actually do use to come up with inferences, rather than the principles of language and logic as suggested by people like Polishin and Fodor, and for that matter, Chomsky. So now, let's come back to our adaptive systems and think about how we are representing students in these adaptive systems, because in order to be an adaptive system, in order to learn about a student, the system is going to have or have to embody some kind of representation of the student, right? Or at least the relevant or salient properties of the student. Now, if our thinking about the representation of the student is equivalent to some sort of triple-based representation a la the semantic web, a la what we know about a person is a series of propositions about that person on which we will make inferences based on some sort of formula like a recommendation engine, then that really is the adaptive system version of drop-down lists, where our representation of a student is going to be based on a very limited and very selected set of patterns. Our representation of the student will be limited by our vocabulary, our language of representation of student, which is why people in the semantic web fight so long and so hard, and they do, about vocabularies. So I'm thinking about this and thinking that adaptive systems are inherently constrained in the same way that our thinking, our traditional thinking about learning is inherently constrained. Because we're trying, in both cases, we're trying to force what we can learn into these logical linguistic structures. So I ask computationally, is there any other way? Well, in learning theory, we have constructionism, Seymour Papert. Yeah, nothing new, right? And it is this complex connectivist idea that what happens in the network is what happens in the neuron. And the idea is that the task of the student, rather than to build propositional-based representations in the mind, is rather to build representations by doing things, by creating things, by being active. And what happens is a person being active, doing, creating in an authentic environment, sorry about that phrase, but creates a representation in the student that is based on or founded in a resemblance with that environment rather than composed of a set of facts about that environment.
Is this constructionism or constructivism?
Constructionism. Yeah, it's a Papert special.
I see the parallels.
Yeah, there's a parallel. Obviously, there's a parallel. So we have perhaps a different model of adaptive system that's either contradictory to or consistent with what Kinshuk had to say, based not on attempting to create a representation of the student in the computer system and then to use that representation to adapt, but rather to, based on resemblances with the student's own constructions, open up new worlds or new vistas. Now here, of course, I'm running out of time as I'm writing this, much less saying it. But what are these worlds? What are these new vistas? They may be sentences, words, books, papers, they may be models, simulations, representations, or they may be networks, people, groups of structures. The idea of the adaptive system, what the adaptive system is trying to do is instead of capturing a representation of the student, is trying to match the student with things that are similar out there in the world. How does it know that they are similar? It looks at the student's own constructions, the student's own creations, and finds what are similar. So it's a similarity-based representational system. And so the network that the student finds him or herself in becomes isomorphic with, in important ways, the students' own representations found in their own mind based on or as modeled by what they have created themselves. I know I'm skipping over a bunch of things here that would probably need to be talked about in detail, but the idea here is that adaptation to a student isn't changing the nature of the system, isn't changing the nature of the computer program. It's rather more like opening up new doors, new vistas, new connections to things that are similar to what the student has already expressed an interest in by virtue of their own perceptions of the world, their own creations based on those perceptions.
I have a question on that. So, to be able to capture what a student has created, a student's own creation, you would need some sort of data input and some sort of representation of that creation in the system, or not?
All you need is the creation.
But how this, because for system to be able to understand a student's creation, it needs some sort of understanding of what it is trying to understand.
It doesn't need to understand the creation. It just needs to find similar things.
And who defines what it will try to find?
Nobody defines.
So something like a kind of neural net or a sort of Bayesian kind of approach where we would look at just similarities out there.
Right.
Would be the kind of thing that we would
do. But who means how it is defined what is created by a student? Because to be able to even see that, system needs to know this is created by a student and how that could be defined.
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking when you're saying how it's defined.
No, how means when you say that a student's creation is needed for system to be able to then find resembling
mm-hmm.
creations.
Right.
So that means system should be able to somehow capture that creation to be able to then go out and get. So how does it know that this is what I need to capture?
Okay. It doesn't know.
Okay.
Okay. It's not an intelligent system. But you can tell it by giving it the thing that you've created.
So a student tells the system.
I'm sorry?
A student tells the system.
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, the intention is for this to be a student-driven system. So the intention is not for the system to be defining to the student what the student should tell the system. The intention is for the student to tell the system. But the student isn't engaged in the act of telling the system. That's not what's happening. That's just a byproduct. The student is engaged in the act of creating, and in that act also occurs the included phenomenon of telling the system. It's like I write a blog post. I'm not telling Blogger that I've created something. I'm writing a blog post. But by writing a blog post, I have, by that fact, told Blogger that I've created a blog post. But I don't go through some sort of song and dance and say, here, I've created this. I just created it.
This is interesting because the only way Blogger would understand that this is your creation is by providing you a box for input.
Right.
That means Blogger must have that information that I need to provide this box so that you can provide some input. And then, as soon as you provide input, there is a predefined structure there that anything that comes in this input is user's creation. Somebody somewhere has to define that in advance before you can actually blog.
No, I don't have to blog on Blogger, though. That's what it is to blog on Blogger. I mean, you're trying to depict some of these things as necessary conditions for the possibility of blogging. And I'm saying that blogging can exist without these necessary conditions.
It strikes me that one has given the system that will adapt and create things, whereas I think Stephen is saying that the student creates the adaptivity that the machine that
yeah.
No, I understand. The only thing I'm not clear, and again, that's just me probably, is to be able to find resembling whatever it is, creation or whatever, from outside, system needs to know this is the input so that it goes out to do that. Similarity.
I think you're trying to get the first stage in a slippery slope argument going here is what I think is happening. I think you're saying, well, if you need this box, then you must need also this other box and also this other box. And is it going to be in this format? Is it going to be in this language? Are you going to use this character representation? And all of these things that I say you don't need, all of a sudden you're going to need, because each step of the way this thing has seemed absolutely necessary and essential. And this is the method of computer programmers. They all these things always seem necessary. I'm sorry?
Sorry?
Cold start.
Yeah.
Well, you need to start from
yeah, means,
but that's not extremely hard in this case, because you're talking about people putting their personal creation, whether it be in separate network connections or pictures or text or whatever it happens to be. Then there will certainly be a point at which the system is going to have a cold start, as much as there need to be enough people doing that in order to be able to find a match. I mean, it's the old collaborative filtering problem. But really, the way this is kind of a collaborative filter approach, I think, that you're talking about. It has kind of it's about looking at things that are like me. And I guess the problem with that is that there's no pedagogical connection between those things. What we're looking at is similarity in real world or in a world and in my personal world, which is great if what we're looking for is somebody who likes the same books. But it's a lot harder if we're looking at something that suggests a path to learn something by.
Sure.
That's an interesting approach.
I think that when I pick up on things that I'd like to pursue on Stevens, it's sort of like which part of the elephant we want to look at first. And I think we've each got different glimpses. And I'm conscious of the time. I just want to get...
sorry.
No, actually...
But I'm really interested. I think that George is the co-creator of Connectivism. I think we should give him a little bit of a chance. He hinted that he was when it went to his response time. Putting you on the spot, George, did the... what was the simple...
Simple connectivism and complex connectivism.
What's your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I will take as a bit of a tongue-in-cheek and a mild self-ego-stroking attempt on the part of Stephen. So I think that was at play behind the words. But and the other aspect I posted, I said, Stephen, the line, I said, this is classifying his views as complex, and Tom Woodward came by and said he doesn't discuss anything below super duper connectivism. So he wasn't interested. But I think the distinction is there's a lot that Stephen was saying that I would strongly agree with, especially the discussion on similarities. But I think it's important to note that Stephen comes at this from a philosophical perspective.
Yeah.
And so his reasoning tracks a philosophical line of reasoning. And in a presentation like this, where you initiate a discussion on connectivism, then move into a discussion on critical literacies, and then begin to move on representation or lack of representation, and then conclude with an emphasis on adaptivity. For lack of a better word, there's a hell of a lot in there that it's very difficult to begin to tackle. I do think, as Stephen noted at the start, that he has a particular problem with his... Problem isn't the right word. He has a bridge with regard to connectivism that he needs to address. I think he somewhat misrepresented my perspective. I think, as I've stated in the past, that with connectivism, I've made basically the core assertion, which I think Stephen are close on, which is that knowledge is essentially a networked entity, and that as you learn, you're pruning, you're growing these networks. And I've listed these networks at three specific levels. One is neural, which is not my area of expertise, so I have to rely on people like Olaf Sporns and others that come by and say, you know what, neural networks exhibit small world phenomena. They exhibit power laws, so to speak. They exhibit all of these various attributes that we've come to expect when we analyze social networks. So that's the first part, and I'm not an expert there, so I have to defer to people who are better informed on this. So what does that mean in terms of thinking? It means that there's a neuron doesn't contain knowledge, but a sequence of neurons that exhibit a pattern, they are representative of a certain type of knowledge. It's the pattern that reflects. So, and not surprisingly, when you have a memory and you call that memory, you literally activate a similar pathway or the similar network will refire at the point of memory as was fired at the point of creation. So what I'm saying is that if I know that this is a laptop, there's no part of my brain where there is a little image of a laptop that exists, and when I have a laptop image, I activate it. It's a sequence of network or a network phenomena that fires across multiple parts of the brain. So from that perspective, then I start to introduce this notion of conceptual networks, which is getting a little bit more into what Stephen's talking about, but it's where you're starting to say that what is knowledge is not specific in an entity, but it is specific in a relationship between multiple entities, which you see happening at any point where you have a major failure in, you know, society or in economics, where someone doesn't have the right information that they need to have a proper understanding of the situation, which enables them to act, such as the Christmas Day bomber, or such as what we now call, you know, the global financial meltdown. So that's the conceptual dimension of knowing, which is where the concepts that we use at a biological level, the neural level, are shaped as concepts, and we use a variety of techniques, such as language and imaging and other critical literacies, which is a good word, to portray that to others in our discourse. Then we have the third element, and this is starting to get a little bit into Dragon's work and a bit into Kinchick's work, and I've found so far this week's been very affirming in that regard. But the third aspect of network learning resides at the external and social levels, which means that my capacity to learn is going to be tied to the people I'm connected with. Just like Stackis and Fowler's work says, if your friends are overweight, there's a chance you might be. If your friend's divorced, there's a greater chance that you will divorce because this phenomenon spreads to and we also start to include external hardware or technology agents. Not quite the outboard brain the way Stephen describes it, but those elements do form part of our network. So I think the elements that Stephen was explaining can be explained at those three particular levels or attributes or network structures. The distinction being, and a bit ironically, is that it is my perspective that is shaping how I represent it, and Stephen's perspective is coming at it from his background, more from a philosophical aspect. So I just want to emphasize, I do think Stephen put a bit of a false dichotomy on the table to consider, and I'm not quite sure why. But nonetheless, that's sort of my quick response.
You have a response to the response?
Yeah.
Well, if you have levels, then you have the same problem I have, which is the moving from one level to another level.
I think this is a huge problem, because they're not the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not your cigar and more cigars, it's the cigars and oceans.
Yeah.
And they're both composed of atoms, and they're both physical objects, and they both could look the same if you looked at them from a certain angle, but I think this is the representations of knowledge in the network out here are quite different from the representations here. And our brains are, I mean, they are, as you say, you've got a full picture of a cigar sitting there in your brain. I have slight worries about the resemblance theory, because I think there's also the issue of, you could also represent it on a picture or in a microprocessor or in a number of different, the representation of this.
But the attributes of those networks, whether you're talking perceptual or neurological or social and external networks, they exhibit similar patterns.
Are the attributes of neural networks really known? They're not very well known.
No, I mean, there's a good article called The Seductive Allure of Neuroscience Explanation, which is always worth emphasizing whenever someone gives you neuronal explanations of things. It's worth thinking that, you know, there's a way in which that is a cop-out argument sometimes. They aren't extremely well-known overall, but if you look at the work of Olaf Sporns at the University of Illinois, he's done a lot of work, and you can access quite a few of his lectures that address exactly that concept, where he's stating the properties of networks. Barabashi has addressed this as well, that exist at social levels, that exist in biological levels. They also exist neuronally, which means you do have key nodes in a neuronal network, and you do have disproportionate connectedness, similar to the Pareto's principle in neuronal networks. But before we get too detailed, I mean, we are talking a bit out of my league, when it comes to neuronal explanations, and that's what I mentioned. I look at neuroscientists who are saying these are attributes of networks. I'm suggesting, with different intent, that the same attributes, the same terminology, and discussion I mentioned on Monday with David Wiley, is that you know you can use one concept to explain learning at those levels, which is the connection-based view and the various patterns of connections exhibit.
There are different kinds of connections because another kind of network is, for example, the spread of disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to suggest that the spread of disease, I have, funnily enough, I've come up with this infection model of learning once or twice, but you know, but to suggest that it's the same kind of thing as the sort of representations of knowledge that we would have on the internet, the representations of the ways in which things work to build my knowledge here, the ways in which knowledge is represented in my head, is the fact that they happen to be networks, they also happen to be composed of atoms. We have to be human beings who are all breathing, all these commonalities. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can infer similarities between apart from that interesting property.
But this is the distinction where I've tried to emphasize not discussing networks that broadly, because networks is really just a representation of patterns, or of connections, I should say.
I like sort of thinking about individual connections.
So I tried to emphasize, focus on the connections. Because, you know, first of all, by focusing on connections, each individual has greater capacity to control. When we talk network theory, it seems too big for focus. But, and this is something that maybe
that's where the difference is. Simple connectivism focus on the connections. Complex connectivism focus on the patterns. I'm much more interested in the patterns than the connections.
Well, I'm focused on the patterns produced by connections. Right. My starting point is, much like Richard Feynman was asked at one time, so, you know, what is the most important thing for a new science student to understand, and he said the world is made of atoms. You know, you get that, and everything else you build from there comes out of that. And when we start talking learning and knowledge and that space, then the first thing, what's the most important thing to understand? I would say understand that connections are the base of this. Once you start to understand connections, how they form, why they form, the patterns they exhibit, then you have a foundation on which you can explore learning that gets into Dragan's emphasis on organizational knowledge and development. You have the ability to move into some of what Kintrup is talking about in terms of personalization, but it must start, in my eyes, with this notion of a connection as being the key formation of everything that comes beyond that. And that's why the emphasis needs to be on understanding and viewing those particular connections, how they shape, why they shape. Much like Lazarsfeld's statement, who talks to whom, about what, and to what effect.
So is the self-similarity important? Networks. I'm with Stephen on the it's the higher level structures that form as a result of those connections. So you look at the brain. Well, yes, you might talk about it being single neurons forming things, but actually the brain's got lots of interesting deep structures that have emerged mostly through network processes, but by no means all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ways in which cognitive parts relate to the limbic parts and all of those sorts of things are just as important. And I guess it is this thing, you know, are all connections the same? And I mean, the answer is obviously no.
Well, this is where, when you say that, what's the value? Can you move from, you know, analyzing biological networks or sexual networks of disease spread to analyzing, you know, stockbrokers? Well, they may be correlated, that's a bad example.
Maybe things that are a little less closely related.
Sorry, I'll try something different. We'll pick whatever else you'd like, you know, spread of SARS. It's interesting to know, and these are questions that aren't answered, which is, of course, the value of this particular week here, is that if there are power laws in social networks, are there power laws in terms of our own conceptual development? I mean, I've read Stephen's stuff probably since right around the time that he started OL Daily, and there's a few themes that come up, which in my eyes, I would say these are power laws in Stephen's cognitive structure. He references his Paris example for meaning. It frequently arises. He has some issues with folks like Chomsky and his ilk. And so there's a sense in which I, by looking at and reading for a period of time, I have a better understanding what are some of the critical nodes that form part of that. They're hubs in his development of thought. So if I read an article and if in my head I say, what would John, how would John respond to this? Or how would Terry respond? If I know them somewhat, I know that this is by nature of how they formed their cognitive structure, whatever you will. They're going to react a certain way. So my argument would be, just like in Christmas religious beliefs, that viewpoint forms a power law or a disproportionately large node, and it will influence everything that they say and that they're willing to receive from a learning perspective. So that's what when you ask, what's the value of thinking of these networks for similar attributes at different stages, that's my response, so that we begin to see that there's some capacity of overlap that influences how we think conceptual development.
So can you use those power laws or that mental conception to drive an adaptation out of kitchens rather than a learning style? Or is that, is learning style just an attempt to get at what that power law is?
This, I would say yes, and this gets back to exactly the question that Stephen was engaged with Kinship about, which is that the rather than predefined structures, if a learner starts to interact with the system, and if the system is capable of evaluating what the learner is saying by whatever means, you would start to recognize consistently, George has perspectives that are, let's say it's a political discussion course, George has perspectives that lean to the right or that lean to the left. And after a period of time, anything that anyone says around me, by virtue of how we function, what I connect to my network conceptually will be shaped by what's already there. So if there's entities that don't resonate with my existing network, my existing structure, they just won't bind.
Why would this not be true if you just had a couple of bags of, let's call them nodes? A couple of bags of similarities, a couple of bags of things that are sufficiently similar that, frozen into a database, run up in MySQL, are they the same? Where's the connection?
Well, same is not exactly similar, but that said, sure.
Well, I would emphasize that it's partly the element in that who I am as a person shapes what I'm prepared to learn and what I'm prepared to hear from others. If I have a political view, and a great experience is read Instapundit and Daily Kos for about a week or two. And
I don't wish that on anyone.
No, but if you want to get a sense of how that works, if you have a certain state of mind, and that's the wrong word, I'm trying to get this conceptual map laid out. If you have that in your mind, who you are and what you know is a better indicator of what you're going to learn than what the instructor has designed for you.
Right.
And so the system of personalization and adaptivity must begin with that who you are as a learner. And then by being able to understand the patterns that you exhibit through your language and through your discourse and through the images that you share and represent, and from that point begin to adapt, not from a curricular perspective otherwise.
And what I'm saying is that the best guide to who you are is what you create.
So if you were basing a pedagogy on this, as it were, you both run courses, and you run courses together, and this whole notion of course, quite strange, I find it.
Well, we've struggled with it too.
So.
Yeah.
It's a tricky one.
We wanted to call it happening, but that was taken too. So.
But it does imply some kind of a pedagogy. I still have difficulty.
Does that creation have to be explicit? Because quite a lot of creation would be inside the mind. Especially for people who are more reflective type. Again, I'm using just a term, just the meaning. You should take the meaning, not the learning style itself. But the people who are not obviously creating, but they are creating a lot in their mind, how do you think system would get that or that this system would not be applicable to them?
I think on one level, we share more through our actions and through our behavior than we think we share. As a typical Facebook example, I mentioned this on Monday, but I don't post anything related to personal beliefs on Facebook. But if someone had a few hours, they could quite quickly figure out my beliefs, political and otherwise, not by what I've said, but by the people that I've chosen to connect with. Because the assumption being that unless I just really like personal frustration, I'm going to start connecting with people who are somewhat like I am. But you're right, there is a limitation.
But the thing is, that whole thing starts with you using Facebook. But there are large majority of people who don't use Facebook or don't use these, again, are they wrong or right? That's a different question. But lot of people, they do not use social networks as other people do. So what about those people who do not use social networks? Means because
They have no personalities.
Yeah, possibly, but that means that may be a right answer. That okay, this system is not for that. That's perfectly fine, as long as we are clear here on that.
My favorite idea about being funded for research was the mathematician who sat on the beach in Rio de Janeiro for 2 years, and at the end of it came up with an equation. And I guess, how do you know about that person?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you know he didn't have the equation on day one?
I would.
Well, I think part of the issue here, and it's important to emphasize this, is that we are not as far along this particular journey as our proclamations suggest that we actually are. Which means that, you know, yes, we can sit here and say, well, this is what connectivism is and this is what network learning is. But I think we're really just at the early stages of it. So it is affirming to see Dragons and your research and the work that John and Terry have been doing with Me2U and now with The Landing. It is affirming to see there's some alignment in that regard. But I think it's important to note that while we perhaps project some strong perspectives on it, the field of exploration is far younger than we're far, we're not as far along. We're not seasoned travelers.
The whole point here is to see how we can actually advance the field. And for that, one question I have is that how do we consider different... No, actually wrong question. How different people could be considered? Because I don't know who is considering here. That's the biggest problem I have. I'm looking from systems perspective. As soon as I do that, I need certain clear... It's from coming from concept to next step.
Okay, well,
need something there that connects those.
Let me put it a different way then. You raise a good question, and a question that I've attempted to trivialize and failed. Sorry, I'm just kidding. But you have a need to get input into your system. And right now, the way your system gets input is by means of forms and things like that, right? Every system?
No. Means again, let's say a system, because my system has no forms. I don't believe in forms, but anyway.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Well, like I say, I wasn't here. But could your system, instead of inputting, well, I don't know what it inputs. So instead of inputting what it inputs, right, could it consist instead of a form of sensory input that is not computational at all, that does not create propositions, that is more of a connectionist system, more of a neural network type of system than a standard bring in data, represent it in a database, represent types of data kind of system?
Okay, at the end of the day, you need, if you want computation at all, you need something to compute. You need something that can be computed. Okay, so that's at one side.
That's like saying for there to be existence at all, you need being.
Exactly.
We need something more informative.
Exactly. So now let's go. What is being inputted that can be used in that way? Now, as I mentioned, we don't have any forms. What we have is information in coming in from various different sources. Could be a temperature at some place. It could be somebody blocked something, and as long as we know that, keep checking that there are these places where people input that anything, any action students do in any system that we have identified, say Moodle, and that anywhere students move, their GPS location, anything that we identify that system can do. Because if we don't identify system is dumb. System doesn't do anything unless we tell it.
How are you representing that input information?
That all input then afterwards get somehow calculated in computational form. So that means it has to be either raw data inputted in the system, or it gets calculated on the client side and the refined summary goes to the system. It all then gets inputted in a database. Yes, that's how computations would happen. That doesn't mean that the blog that somebody put, that what is being put inside the system may not be the blog. Maybe the pattern coming out of it, that, okay, this person, as George mentioned, has left inclination. That information goes in the system, that's fine, but that information is now in a database. And now, when adaptivity happens, that time system looks at all the information that is being stored, then to find certain clues out of it. And those clues are coming from by putting that information through neural networks.
But that information is basically a set of sentences, a set of triples, or some such thing.
It could be numbers. It's a silly example. You might store a hash value that represents a picture somebody had done and compare that with somebody else's.
Yeah. Can I say, like, representation I'm going to use will be the one which will be the best, I mean, which will be the most suitable corresponding to the goals of my user.
Yeah.
I don't care. I don't have assumptions whether it's a perfect or it's a natural language or it's a ontology or if it's
And interestingly, because we are not using one source, so that's the, for example, one of my colleagues is working on natural language processing, so he brings things completely differently than another colleague who is working in who has a lot of interest in location sensors, and he brings information in a completely different format, and here this poor guy has to make sense out of this. And the way we are using agents. Agents then do different type of calculations on different kind of information and tries to bring
it in. And I'll let Stephen take the argument on whether that works in his perspective or not in terms of those multiple systems. My perspective is exactly the concern that you're bringing, or that your approach, multiple sources, multiple points of information, that exactly, in my eyes, each one of those elements is a node, and how those nodes are connected will produce a pattern that will then enable the student to act, or that will make sense to someone. The same way that these points of information, Christmas Day bomber, 9/11, subway, whatever, all of those issues, they were points of information, there were no elements available. The problem is that people who needed to decide
did not have
the nodes connected properly. They had them, they weren't connected. So. Patterns, and this is why I try to emphasize, don't look at the network, look at the connection entities.
Patterns were not coming out of that. That's the problem. Means, if you had certain historical data and somehow system could create patterns out of it, and as soon as you get new information coming in from different sources, and you can connect it in the way, or you connect it in different ways until you find some match with the previous pattern, that's how you make resemblance, basically.
Let's just do a little process thing. First, Mike Barber from Wayne State has joined us, just coming in for the e-learning contest, amongst other things, so welcome, Michael. We really only have about half an hour, and I'm sure that these guys could go on for a lot longer than that, but I do want to open the door to somebody who hasn't had a comment or a question, either directly to Stephen or to Kim Chuck. Or this is Dragan's last day with us too, so I hope that we can sort of allow a little more others. But I think we should probably just continue the discussion if you're all right. I know that you were scheduled to have this time.
That's fine.
So
I have a question, and I don't know if it's a sidewinder or what. At one point, I'd love to get back at your slides. At one point, you talked about, I thought it was connectivism equaling truth, or true, I think at one point. It might have been on the slide with the triple at the top and the true with as the second.
I think the slide is probably the one where there's the truth and resemblance.
You equated the concept, I think, representational concept
is
equaling truth.
Right. Cognitivism, representations are like sentences, triples, etc. Right. Representational realism, grammar guaranteed by principles of mind, world, to be true.
Right. And my sort of fundamental sort of bring up the word that we used all day yesterday, ontological question, about the concept of truth. How do you define it from the perspective of each of us has a different truth? We're all, at the very least, we can't agree on a truth. At the very most, for a period of time, a group of us might decide that something is true and go along with that until there's something enters the equation that offers a different truth, if you like. So how does that concept of truth play into your underlying thinking of simple versus complex? I've lost the word.
Connectivism.
Well, George and I have different views, and maybe you have a different view too. But I mean, there's a whole bunch of theories of truth, like Tarski semantics. Snow is white is true if and only if snow is white, in which there's some sort of link between the proposition and whatever the proposition stands for. Obviously, when I'm saying that we don't have a mechanism whereby the proposition stands for something, but rather the representation is representation by virtue of resembling something, then I don't have a corresponding theory of truth. The resemblance relation is as close as I get to truth, right? So now the question comes up, what do I think truth is on a picture like that? And my response is generally to follow the sort of position advocated by David Hume in thinking of truth as the strength or the veracity of the representation, the forcefulness of the image. So something that is you see, and the terminology doesn't naturally lend itself. The language doesn't help me a bit.
The language doesn't exist to give you a sense of what it is. So then my question is, how do you then apply that or place
let me try to draw this out, because it does play a role. Okay, so a representation is a set of connections. Connections can have strength. So entity A and entity B are connected. That connection can be very strong, so such that the signal from entity A will be guaranteed to be propagated to entity B, or it can be weak, where that propagation is lower as a probability or lower as an intensity. So the pattern of connectivity that may represent a state of affairs in the world can be very strong or very forceful by virtue of those strong connections. Okay? Now, the role that plays is that these connections are more salient, which means when you're questioning whether one thing resembles another, if you have a more salient representation, certain properties will be more relevant in the comparison of similarity.
So I would argue, I guess my sort of fundamental argument with that is that what's strongest belief is not necessarily the truth. That there are examples where truth is sort of off to the side, and as it grows stronger, it becomes more prevalent in the bigger picture. But that there could be opportunities where what is considered to be the masses belief system is fundamentally not true.
But you see, I would turn that around and say, what is the best evidence for something being true than that it is strongly believed?
Well, at one point, we strongly believed the world was flat. We found out.
And at that time, we said it is true that the world is flat.
Yes, and I'm arguing that just simply that the fact that the majority thinks something is true, or that it's a strong truth, doesn't necessarily negate the fact that their belief system has created a strength in a truth that is untrue.
Today,
general problems.
We strongly believe that they were wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm just wondering how that concatenation of thinking throws on top of the sort of network processing sort of concepts that you've presented, and how that sort of throws a wrench into some of the things that may be playing out.
This is starting, I guess, where this notion of how you bring pieces together determines what it ultimately becomes. But if you were to look at a lot of the information that, or the evidence...
Recording in progress.
It represented something to the individuals who are perceiving it. And I guess I'm trying to emphasize, for now at least, because I don't know if we are quite far enough along where we can start to make those kind of, some of these questions around, network learning and what exactly it is in that regard. I think now I'm more interested in saying, how do entities connect? Why do they connect? What is the impact of those connections? And some of the more philosophical aspects of truth and truthfulness and that, I'm not really that interested in right now, at least, because I'm more interested in trying to say, what is it that's in front of me? Like, why are these pieces coming together in a certain way if I'm supposed to act meaningfully in whatever regard? I read my RSS reads, I read some blogs here, I read some journal articles there, I have a few conversations there. How am I supposed to understand what's happening in the world of technology? I mean, that's part of my goal. That's why I'm engaging in these activities. So I'm trying to connect these pieces and bring them together in a meaningful way. Some elements resonate with me, and I adopt them as part of the network. Others don't, and I kind of let them fall to the wayside until I've matured and developed somewhat, or perhaps the concepts evolve. So I guess what I'm trying to get to is these broader epistemological questions aren't tremendously high on my radar right now. There are others who find that to be far more intriguing, but for me, the emphasis is on the structure of network growth, pairing through these connections, forming and breaking down.
But one way to understand that you meant that could be the next step in the development of the field is to translate some of these propositions into questions that can be explored and investigated empirically, and provide a collective basis.
It doesn't always matter if you can say with certainty that something is true. If you can use the knowledge that you have and to obtain your outcomes, then that's often true. And the scientists are often faced with these problems.
That's the next stage on the semantic web, isn't it? We've got ontologies, now we need epistemologies.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's got to be a language for
them. Yeah. But if you're putting truth in there, that's all I'm suggesting. If you're putting truth on the table, be prepared to talk about it and deal with it. And that's why I brought it up, because it's
I'll put truth on the table. Yeah, I think you have to put truth on the table, because otherwise there'll be people who come along and say, "Oh no, we've worked all this out, right?" And they haven't.
And it hasn't been. And that's all I'm saying is that if you're going to put it on the table, it has to be part of the conversation. Yeah.
Related to what you're saying, you're talking about the strength of a connection, but there's also probability, which is approximately what you said. Probability of those forming collections of connections, and George says that ultimately determines what the new knowledge is going to be. But it's sometimes the improbable and difficult connections that are actually going to come up with new aha moments and new bits of knowledge. So if we, that's why I was asking you on Monday, if we can come up with those laws. We could come up with those laws somehow and look at not just the strength of connections but the probability. What is it that brings two bits of knowledge together? And how might we, encourage improbable connections?
And that's if you look at what happened in September 2008. Up until then, in most of the advanced economic thought, this model of the market will police itself really the dominant mindset. There were a few fringe players, but really they were so outside of the main dialogue as to not essentially be counted, which is why Krugman and others who predicted this were marginalized, because their ideas didn't resonate with the network. Suddenly this event happened, and the one key lesson that came out of this, which is still resonating in terms of implications, is that markets don't do a great job of policing themselves. That was the key insight, and since then, suddenly, a whole new set of resonance factors start to come in. now we're finding these people who said this was a bad idea this are starting to be coming. So I think that's why I try to emphasize connections, because that one new piece can dramatically change the structure of what an entire existing network or frame of thought means to a generation.
Now, I mean, to talk about this on a completely different level, but not to contradict what George has just said, because I don't think it does contradict what George has said. If you look at things like Boltzmann functions for connectivity, the firing of a neuron is based on an activation function. It's not just an on-off, right? So the probability that the neuron will fire, and it's always a probability, so it could fire at any time, but the probability that the neuron will fire goes up and up at a certain rate according to the input as it comes in. And if you mess around with that probability, then you can produce interesting effects. And one of the major effects is to produce unexpected but stable connections through a process of what is called annealing. And what you do, and annealing is exactly as it sounds. It's exactly the same equation. And what you do is you take the probability function that the neuron will fire, and you crank it all the way up. So now your network, your neurons are firing all over the place. And then you slowly turn it back down. Because what happens is when you have probabilities of connections, you have probabilities of firing, if you just leave them stable, the network will settle into what's called a local minimum, right? It'll pick the first most comfortable place. It's kind of like you throw a marble onto a table. Even if the table's got all kinds of ridges and valleys, it'll just find some place to settle. It might not be the lowest. It'll just be the most convenient. But if you shake the table up, right, and do it over time, there's a probability that eventually the marble will fall into the lowest, deepest depression and stay there. And that's that unexpected conclusion. That's the conclusion that you get after something dramatic happens, as George just described. Sorry, Diego Liel is dinging me. Oh, microphone's not on, that's why. Sorry, Diego.
I'd like to focus more a little bit on the instructional design kind of implications, especially if connectivism, and maybe that could be a task for our last afternoon. But anyways, so it's something that's been bothering me for a long time. Is, you know, especially as we try to get connectivism and jam it into formal education and say, is it jammable or can it work or should it work? And that's why I really like Stephen, and I guess maybe you and George worked this out on your first courses, but aggregate, remix, forward, those three things. And maybe that is in nature the instructional design or the essence of what a connectivist learning activity should be. But the question that I have is that is it scalable? And it's like constructivism isn't scalable in the large.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if connectivism is scalable down to 20 students or something like that, because it seems like it's become associated with open course, with hundreds, thousands, with varying degrees of participation, such that there's maybe a power law that the vast majority, you don't even know if they're there, and there's a few very active learners. And so if you're going to take that model and bring it down to 30 people, you might only have one active person and the other 29 doing nothing kind of thing. So just be interested in, especially Steve, you might not be here another day, but just to respond on, I don't know what the size of the literacies one is, but what are your thoughts about it as an instructional design in formal education?
Critical literacies, just so you know, has 270 students signed up, and the active base is a lot smaller, as one might suspect. So, scaling down. I mean, my first question is, why would you do that?
Yeah.
I know you can probably give me some stories about why you would do that, but
I guess one reason you would do that would be that you would want to be more inclusive. I guess the part of the worry I have is that when you've got very well-connected modes, very charismatic people at the center of these networks, you act as kind of strange attractor, not actually a very unstrange attractor. I mean, a very clear, central, well-connected mode. Yeah. And even then, I've watched what George has been doing recently with this kind of thing, and I just see the energy that he puts into it. I saw the energy that you put into the last one. It's just enormous. And, you know, how do you make that? But even then, you've got 19 out of 20 not really participating to any great degree. And I guess that's the worry, is how do you... I mean, should those 19 not have been involved?
Oh, no, certainly you want them.
Is it possible without you guys?
Without a superintendent, no, as teacher.
Well, part of my argument is that it does happen, although it's interesting. I mean, I say it does happen because there's lots of communities all over the place that form spontaneously around a certain subject. Although, thinking about the way you've just phrased that, I'm just thinking somebody I read recently said, and accurately, behind any one of these communities is typically some super committed person. So...
I would say that would be the case in any good course, even in a traditional course, right? I mean, I don't think that's a... You know,
but in a traditional course, then, the other 19 are included. And I guess that's the...
Why limit the microcosm to the group that is in a course? Why not conceptualize learning as... Even if you have a small group of 20 people, why not conceptualize learning so that people can bring in their own...
Yeah.
Network and even into the form of
Stephen said something there just now, which is communities establish all the time. But I'm wondering whether one of the things I worry about with connectivism is some barrier to entry, is that when a community establishes itself, it grows slowly and then maybe each is a critical mass. But I wonder whether connectivism or a connectivism type course, if you're not in there at the start or whatever, it's sometimes difficult to get up to speed, you know, because you can be swamped by information. That was certainly my perception when I looked at the course, and it's something that, you know, with our own work we've been worrying about, is that, you know, it's how do you join a community that's established like that when there's an overload of information.
You don't know the language.
Like that.
These aren't existing communities. Well, the time differentiated period of learning, I guess, that students decide when it starts and when it stops. Yes, but it could trickle on, I suppose.
Well, we found with CCK08 in particular that whether we use Vygotsky's concept of scaffolding or not, we found that once the course is done, there are still students that are actively involved and collaborating with each other. They formed, as I mentioned on Monday, you know, when you have a course this large, people have to, of necessity, to manage the amount of information, they have to break into smaller networks and begin to make sense in their own social systems that are formed as. But the thing is that those social systems are fluid. You can come and go, and you can just sort of skip networks as long as you want until you find one that connects with you. But I think this concept of scaling down is very interesting because my first interest in blogging, I was at Red River College, and there was no one there who had an interest in pedagogy and learning in the same level I did, and I couldn't connect with people there. So I scaled down to one node, which was me, and started blogging. And as a result of scaling down to that node, and by just the element of networking is if you make yourself transparent, there's a prospect for connection. As long as you're not transparent, you're right. It's like Darnell said, these 19 people, there's no prospect for connection if you're not making yourself transparent. You can learn by Vayner's concept of it's peripheral participation.
Yeah.
Sorry?
To be invisible.
Well, yeah, by sharing your ideas, you're being transparent. That's an odd way. Good point of clarification. So, I guess...
When I share my ideas, I'm opaque.
Okay, well, at least these Wittgensteins in the room. The challenge, I guess, is, or I would be quite comfortable saying, if we define connectivism somewhat as relating to this notion of knowledge being a networked phenomena and process... And then we say that learning then consists of pruning connections or growing connections. If we're somewhat okay with that definition, then I would say absolutely you could scale it down to a small number of people. Our current iterations have been much larger, but I think it happens every day when a person sits down at a computer and decides, I'm going to read these blogs, but I won't follow these on RSS. I'm going to aggregate these particular resources by using NetVibes, but not these. I'm going to connect with Kinshook and by going. So each time my capacity increased, it's a function of how I reshape my network. Because every individual in a MOOC, like this massive open online course, every individual in that is a member of numerous other networks, and they bring their capacity to bear in these open courses. So this notion of weak ties that we talked about on Monday, each person in that course potentially is an introduction to an entire domain of learning beyond that. So I would say if you've got two or three people together, you conceivably have a very rudimentary network, which means network learning would function.
I've just done this with four people, two of whom were very peripherally involved, and was somewhat shocked after many years of experience of trying similar things to find very little participation. I don't think I was putting enough energy into it. What I have discovered, though, is that there is a graph that you can draw between time and number of people. And it's just that these people just wanted a lot more time. So the course officially ended a month ago, a couple of weeks ago. But it's continuing. And in that way, eventually, there'll be some kind of a snowball, and if that happens, it's just a lot. So that might be one way to scale, I guess. It's just take longer, much longer.
On the one hand, you say that people who are more alike are likely to come together, birds of a feather, which is true. We know that from our networks. But on the other hand, if you read the literature of networking, innovation, and HR literature, you actually need diversity, a certain degree.
Recording in progress.
For it to be effective to build knowledge. So
that's a problem we have too. And in the past, that I've just sort of chalked that up as it's a literacy that needs to be developed. Very much as we could say you can teach a person to read, but teaching them to remember what they read and critically reflect are stages, advanced versions of to read. So I think when we start talking, you can share with people the value of networking, but if you want to amplify the value of networking, then it's important to start thinking of who do you read or engage with regularly that you disagree with? Which people do you engage with that are counter perspective to yours? So it's like the literacy that where we want individuals to intentionally go outside of their, I hate the word echo chamber, but that's sort of what I mean now, outside of the voices they agree with. And I think that's the educational intervention role. That's where the educator comes in and sits down with students in a class and says, who are you reading? What kinds of ideas are you being exposed to? Or in a corporate setting, right? Who are you interacting with? So that we, because innovation itself requires diversity. These random connections don't come through closely clustered groups that all think the same. They come from those odd outside, think slightly out of the ordinary stream.
Let me
get
the second part of that question was the formal education as opposed to informal learning. And let's assume that constructivism can be used to guide both of those. And the big difference in my mind is there's an assessment at the end of the formal and the credentialing that tends to come along with it. Now, we could argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's certainly the model that pays the salary of almost everyone around this table. So, of the 19 people who are very peripherally involved in the Connectivist course, they are probably not doing the feedback. And maybe they are aggregating, maybe they're remixing and repurposing, but they're not posting very much while I'm making this up. Maybe they are. I really don't know. But
no, trust me, they're not.
So yeah. If they're not repurposing, and if this is a formal system, then they fall. Mm-hmm. Or their credential as having
well,
literate.
It's not that they flunk, it's that they don't get the credential. There's a big difference,
yeah,
right?
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't get the credential. They don't get the learning, I guess.
Yeah. They get less learning, probably. Yeah, I would say, there would be a relation. But, that's going to vary probably from person to person. Sometimes it just takes one thing to tweak you. And then you go off and on a tangent. That happens to me all the time, where just one thing will catch my mind, and away I go, and I've got a whole new theory which has been invented three ways over Sunday, but I didn't know it before anyhow. But you know, I describe, and I think this is relevant in some other talks, I describe assessment of what you've done by performance in the network rather than by repetition of any particular bit of knowledge, etc. And I think that in actual real communities, that is in fact how people are assessed. And it might be vindictive and unfair, but it's probably what actually happens. And what I mean by that is a person who wants to be a physicist, a carpenter, or whatever, participates in a group of physicists or carpenters or whatever, does the sorts of things that physicists, carpenters do through this model of, imitation and reflection, attempting to create similar artifacts to what they've perceived. You know, and they're not thinking of it in that light. They're just thinking of, I want to be like so-and-so. And then they behave, act, create in this network, and it's that behavior taken as a whole rather than as a set of constituent elements that leads other people as a whole to come to the assessment whether or not this person is a qualified so-and-so. And it's a very different model of assessment, right? And it's something that would have been completely impractical other than in very small towns or very large, very connected communities. But you can't do it in a very large, less connected community because you need to have this public performance aspect of it. And even now, a lot of people are uncomfortable with the public performance. They prefer just to get the credential and not have to perform in public because it's safer.
So pick up on a small point that you mentioned about this notion of amplification or one idea sort of connecting, opening up sort of vistas. But the read a paper on latent semantic analysis which looked at exactly that. And that's a really key question which says, you know, why is it that sometimes there's far more learning inherent in one connection than you would expect from that one entity? I mean, you know, learning that one new piece of information suddenly produced a far greater structure of knowledge. And I think the primary reason is that as we develop conceptually, we do, because we're sort of ad hoc forming new, you know, our ideas and developing understanding, all of a sudden you have that one piece that comes in and plugs one of these conceptual spaces that suddenly spiders out a whole new sequence of
connections. Great suggestion.
And as a result, yeah, it's really a network cascade effect. And so I think that's the dimension where you have a student that maybe is a little more passive at one stage in the course, suddenly has that one connection, aha moment, and it's disproportionate to what they've gained for information, but suddenly their knowledge grows that much more rapidly. And how that translates into accreditation is a secondary issue altogether.
Yeah.
At the moment, there's a shuttle bus coming in from the airport yesterday. I mean, those things can happen anywhere and not necessarily as a result of the network. That was simply a result of the, I noticed that they've had new signs saying downtown and West End. Whole cascade of things about technology and how it evolved. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the thing about going back to, I mean, I'm not sure whether Terry's question was quite answered, because I think the alpha model, is kind of about an approach to learning within a network, which works, I think, very well within an informal setting. But George started answering some things, I think, which are related to the corollary of that in a formal setting, which is the approaches to teaching. And I just wonder, I mean, do you guys have thoughts about what a teacher should be in this kind of setting? I mean, a teacher in the loosest terms, you know, so I might be talking about a document or a movie or a person or a whatever.
Teacher should be a model, properly so-called.
But I would say the attributes, the activities that a teacher engages in, you know, maybe harder to answer what a teacher should be. But, you know, when we did this course within the landing at Athabasca, we did an 8-week course on how to teach and learn in social and technological networks. And really, I think there's a few key attributes for an educator, because as, you know, such as amplifying, you have to find the important messages and whether it's as simple as a retweet but you amplify the message, and that increases the ability for people to be exposed to it. You have to serve as a curator, and I'm a strong believer in curatorial teaching, but you select the resources and the pieces that you feel are important in defining what's involved in the field. And that, again, is another technique that you use to get learners to encounter some of the important ideas. It's always going to be contextual, because in one course, learners will explore it for themselves. So as an educator, your role is to provide those elements that they're not necessarily discovering on their own. Certainly elements like aggregation and modeling that Stephen's mentioned, persistent social presence is critical. You know, there's a variety of these attributes that learner or that the teacher engages in. Because if, for me, the issue is a control shift. If the learner has the control, then the role of the educator needs to play in areas where learners aren't doing things for themselves. If they can gain access to information, that the educator begins to play in those areas that can serve to develop conceptual understanding.
So if I think about it, I think about adaptive systems. Systems are adapted by actually looking for those things, seeing where the could identify clusters of things that could be amplified. Might be a better approach for adaptive.
I don't personally like the idea of amplification, because noise amplified is still noise.
That's intentional.
You're assuming the instructor will be somewhat familiar with the field, so if a student, let's say in the daily.
Yeah, it's a pretty big assumption.
With critical your current course, you amplify voices of posts that an individual's made, you comment on it, because you feel it somehow resonates or somehow reflects a key idea you're trying to communicate in the course.
Yeah, but there's a really important limit to that, and you know, I'm very careful to tell people to go away, to read other things, to not just simply receive what I have to say. I try not to create a network that is too large. I don't want another boing boing, because to become a boing boing, you really do have to amplify the trivial. So I don't see that function as the teaching function in what I do. What I see as the teaching function in what I do is the carrying on with the act of reading and thinking and trying to come up with new theories and trying to build things and testing ridiculous concepts of online courses and all of that sort of stuff. You know, everything from the giving of talks to the writing of software to, you know, and the newsletter is just one part of that. And so it's more the functioning, I see it more in the functioning of a role model. And people look at what I do and they say, look at him. He can actually make a living doing that. And I could probably do it rather better and make an even better living. You know, it's not just, and this is really important, it's not just showing how, it's also giving permission. The fact that I can do things and do so publicly gives other people permission to do so, and that plays a really large role. The amplification is incidental, because as long as there's some propagation, amplification really means nothing more than how long or short a time it is before something carries forward. If it's useless, indeed, you don't want much amplification, because you want the longer-term dampening effects of the network as a whole to take effect.
One of my blog posts gets noted in OL Daily. It's amplified.
Not so much anymore. I've pretty much, you know, there are louder, many, many more louder voices than me now.
I tell you what I see on my
Recently?
I'm not saying yours is the only one.
Yeah, no.
That is an amplification function.
Yeah.
And my view is that it's the educator that amplifies, because an educator knows, like, if you have a group of students in a course, I mean, and this is my perspective, there are certain elements in a course. Let's say you're doing, instructional design. Agree or disagree with the concept in general, but there are certain elements that are well-defined in the field that are important ideas. So when a student then comments or posts on something, and an educator says, this is no different than the Atelier model, where you used to have a group of students around with a master painter, and says, oh, come on over here, let's look at what Bob just painted. This is brilliant. Mm-hmm. Let's look at his technique. Or, you know, Jane, what she did over here was spectacular, her use of color. Because by pointing that out, it's a teaching moment by saying, ah, look at this here. So I think amplification from an educator's role is critical, because you're aligning what you liked or what you feel that a student did, wrote, created, that was reflective. Like Wendy Drexler's video that's been seen 70,000 times, or just shy of 70,000 now, that's been amplified. Mm-hmm. I've amplified it in presentations because I'm using it as an indication of this is what happens when students have autonomy to create and work on their own.
You're broadcasting, actually, more than amplifying, and I guess
that's the problem.
I mean, big tech workloads. And I had a very interesting corollary of what we were talking about earlier. Why do I use that word? That was last sentence. correspondent between what we were talking about, you know, when Kinchin was talking about the lecture and what was the role of the lecture and would there actually be any value in the lecture, and part of that was that you were saying modeling a way of being. But really, it's the fact that in a network, you're not. There's not this artificial hierarchy. There's just simply a lot of people connecting to you that makes you a teacher.
Well, let's come back to the lecture for a second. I wasn't here for that, but I've seen, and George gave me a capsule summary. Thank you. Let's think about the lecture I just gave. There's two ways of looking at it, the wrong way and the right way. The wrong way is to think that I'm broadcasting and attempting to propagate a certain set of ideas. And if you took what I said as that, then you've kind of missed the point of the lecture. What I was attempting to do is work through a series of ideas in a public place so that you could see me working through the series of ideas. And if that works for you, if you draw some sort of sense of how that can be done, you know, forget the content, right? Did that mechanism of working through those series of ideas work? Then it was successful.
It wasn't simply a purely cognitive task. I mean, there were things at play, such as ego and...
Oh, all kinds of stuff. Yeah,
you
yeah,
had
yeah.
Well, an
yeah.
encounter with Dragon.
Yeah.
You had some discussions that. Right. So that there's much more at play than I think simply working through a series of ideas.
Oh,
there's,
absolutely.
There's
in a public environment.
Yeah. Did well? Like one question I will ask myself later: did I respond in the right way to Dragon? Right. Maybe, maybe not. Were there better ways of doing it? Right. The lesson here isn't, did I win the argument with them? Nobody wins these kind of arguments, right? It's a little flame war inside a room, right? The lesson is, was this the best way of handling it? Everybody looking at this saying, well, I would have handled it differently, or, well, maybe I would have just closed up the laptop and left because he's so obviously right. I must be wrong, you know? How do you respond to that? What are the mechanisms? You know, and all of that is what I'm demonstrating. And this is what, just as an aside, but a relevant one, this is what I'm trying to get at with that talk. If you think the talk is just the words and sentences in the talk, you've taken something that's very large and complex and narrowed it down into something that's very abstract, precise, and simple, and completely misrepresented the talk. That's why I had all those shadow figures in there, to give you an alternate story, in case you didn't like
recording
the words.
Recording in progress.
Sorry. The Illuminate keeps cutting out.
I mean, we can keep
Does that make sense?
Here, but we're technically past 4.
We are.
Yeah.
So this is not something that gets resolved very readily, and it needs an awful lot more discussion, because even our word use is still imprecise, and there
yeah,
are
yeah.
different perspectives that we're trying to tackle. Don't even begin to address this, so... I think it's probably not a bad time to say wrap her up.
Yes, and just say thanks to Stevens for the presentation, and enjoyed both of them, and the working through. I finally did get that, Stephen, and I appreciated that. And I think in my own little reflection on the Dragon incident was saying there must be more here that I'm missing, and mm-hmm. rather than and trying to check that.
Yeah.
But and you're saying it was the process. Was the story,
yeah.
And to
Anyways, now I'm talking again. So let's remember that if you want to do a social activity, highly recommend to go to the brand new art gallery. They close it at 7, and there are lots of. And George, are you going to?
Yeah, I was going to. I have a 4:30 call, so if we meet at 5 o'clock at the Matrix, if that's okay for people who want to go, and we'll do a group walk down, get caught in a rainstorm, I'm sure. But if you haven't had a chance, and if nothing else, just you know, a new building in Alberta, it's really quite something. So it's you know, it won't be a horribly long social event if you're interested. But we can scroll down there, and we should be done by 7. And those of you that want to grab a bite to eat or whatever, there's certainly lots of options.
What's the address, George?
It's
right by City
Churchill
Hall.
Square.
Winston Churchill Square, where the public library is. It's right on the square.
Right, but the square has four sites.
Yes.
You know what? The nice thing, I'm not sure if you've seen the new gallery.
No, I haven't been there at all. So.
It's so distinct.
Okay, it's the new building on Churchill Square.
It's on the east side.
Oh, thank you. Perfect. On the east side, wasn't there a mall? Oh, no, that's the other side. Okay, yeah. Good.
So it will be 102 something.
No, no, it'll be like 4 Churchill Square. Remember the number?
Yeah.
Okay, so for those of you who are listening online, that pretty much wraps us up. So I hope you enjoyed it. Sorry about the sound cutting up from time to time. And I'm going to ask you all if you could leave the room now so that I can save the recording. I've also saved it on Audacity, so the bits that were blank will actually be filled out. So really, I had fun. I hope you did too. So, bye.
Anyone who can take off your order?